We're going to get right into the scriptures this morning with only a brief setting of the scene. Last week we left the sons of Israel in a bad state, both spiritually, which is of course most important and drives everything else, but also politically, economically, physically. The Jews had returned to doing evil after 40 years of rest that followed Othniel's deliverance. The Lord's response to this falling away from him was to sell his people into the hands of Eglon, the king of Moab. We had that in verse 14 at the end of last time. Eglon has set up his palace in the Jericho area. And this is especially galling for the Jews, as this was the scene of their first great triumph when they entered into the promised land. And perhaps now that's all starting to seem like an awful long time ago. As we come to our text for this morning, the Jews have been serving Eglon for 18 years. So we'll read verses 15 and 16 again. But when the sons of Israel cried to the Lord raised up a deliverer for them, Ehud, the son of Gera, the Benjamite, a left-handed man. And the sons of Israel sent tribute by him to Eglon, the king of Moab. Ehud made himself a sword which had two edges, a cubit in length, and he bound it on his right thigh under his cloak. Apparently, it takes 18 years this time for the Jews to realize that they had better seek the Lord about their desperate situation. Remember, before it was 8 years. Now it's 18 years. The Jews were becoming more and more hardened to their sin with each cycle and taking longer to become humbled enough to repent. But the Lord is still ready to come to the aid of Israel when Israel seeks its God. His plan is to once again raise up a deliverer, in this instance a man named Ehud. This man is a lefty, which is not rare for a Benjamite, as we go ahead to Judges chapter 20, verses 15 and 16. We read, from the cities on that day, the sons of Benjamin were numbered, 26,000 men who draw the sword, besides the inhabitants of Gibeah, who were numbered 700 choice men. But out of all these people, 700 choice men were left-handed. Each one could sling a stone at a hare and not miss. So they were sort of known for having these left-handed warriors. And there's an irony here in that the word Benjamin means son of my right hand. The Hebrew words translated left-handed reads literally hindered in the right hand. So you have a person in the tribe, son of my right hand, who is left-handed or hindered in his right hand. Interesting. So it seems that God's having a little fun here by making so many Benjamites left-handed. Each year the Jews had to send a tribute to Eglon for the privilege of being able to live in their own land. This tribute was, of course, in the form of gifts, presents, money, so forth. This arrangement has been very common throughout history. Conquerors have demanded payments of livestock, gold, material goods, etc., in return for not exterminating the local populace, sometimes for not enslaving them, for providing them with a certain amount of stability through kind of enforcing a peace in the area. In Jesus' day, of course, that that tribute was in the form of taxes that was paid to Rome. So this became a common thing for the Jews in their unbelief to have to pay tribute to a conqueror. We do not know why the Jews chose Ehud as the leader of this party that would take the tribute to Eglon. It was certainly appropriate that a Benjamite would take it because the king lived in that tribe's territory, Benjamin. Perhaps he volunteered and gave the Jews reason to believe that he would attempt something daring. Perhaps he was already recognized as a leader among the people, as a potential deliverer. In any case, Ehud prepares to make the most of his opportunity. He fashions a special weapon, a long dagger of about 18 inches that could be hidden along his right thigh. To me, it kind of resonances of Jesus fashioning a whip that he then used to great effect among believers. But here we have another person fashioning a weapon with which to chastise the opponents of the true God. 18 inches. We've had an 18-year time of subjugation, and now a weapon that's 18 inches long. I'll bet if I was really into spiritualization and symbolism, I could come up with something really wonderful about how the number 18, you know, is coming up here. But we'll just move on, actually. When all is ready, Ehud and those designated to carry the various offerings set off for the palace. Verses 17 through 20. He presented the tribute to Eglon, king of Moab. Now Eglon was a very fat man. It came about when he had finished presenting the tribute that he sent away the people who had carried the tribute. But he himself turned back from the idols which were at Gilgal and said, I have a secret message for you, O king. And he said, keep silence. And all who attended him left him. Ehud came to him while he was sitting alone in his cool roof chamber. And Ehud said, I have a message from God for you. And he arose from his seat. Ehud and his companions are ushered into the throne room to make the official presentation to the king. Eglon is described as obese, which was not an uncommon condition for rulers. Most people throughout history have not had enough food available to them and not enough leisure time to become fat. So it was a sign of power and wealth that Eglon could be living this large. His weight carried a price, however. The time of year was evidently summer, and the king was hot and sweating. He was happy to see the gifts, but what was really on his mind was getting to the cool chamber that he had caused to be built on the palace roof. So he dismisses the party quickly and heads for more comfortable accommodations. We can't be sure of Ehud's plan as he came before the king with the tribute. It seems likely that his original thought was to fall upon the king during the presentation of that tribute. Would you like a closer look at this beautiful fabric, Your Immensity? Come forward, and then, you know, as he gets closer, does something with that. That would surely have cost him his life if it had played out that way. And he was willing to give his life. But whether because of the brevity of the audience with the king or too many guards between Ehud and his target, he does not act at that time. It may also be that he kind of saw the situation, maybe from some things that were being said, understood the king's mind about what you know, he wanted to do, overheard talk about the cool chamber, whatever. It could be that he formulated a new plan as the situation developed. Ehud and the others were escorted out of the palace and sent on their way down the road through Gilgal, which was on the eastern edge of Old Jericho. And it's interesting to ponder what they were thinking. Had they thought that maybe Ehud would, you know, do something? You know, what was he thinking? An opportunity, you know, missed or what? But when Ehud reaches Gilgal, he tells the party to go on while he returns to the palace. And we read of idols here. We came to the idols at Gilgal. Remember that it was at Gilgal that the Jews had raised a memorial to God with 12 stones representing the 12 tribes from the Jordan River, crossed in the dry, you know, area that the Lord had brought about, took stones and made a monument there. Possibly Eglon was now bragging about the power of his gods over the power of Yahweh, and had placed idols at this very place where they had renewed their covenant with Yahweh. Now you had these abominations. It might be that the sight of these monstrosities inflames Ehud's holy zeal for the Lord. That he realizes this just can't be borne. We can't have another day of this. The Lord still wants to use me here. He wants to see God have the victory over this pagan people. In any case, he heads back alone to begin this reclaiming of Israel's godly heritage. Quite a moment, quite a move. So Ehud shows back up. We thought that you guys had left. Oh no, you know, just one more thing here. And he's brought before the king. And now the situation is much more conducive to his designs. Of course, by the Lord's working. The king is now in comfort. He's in a smaller, more manageable location. To increase the advantages, Ehud makes it known to the king that the message that he has returned to give is a secret one. That there's something here just for the king. The implication is that the king would not want this news to be overheard. This wasn't something that he would want to be gossiped about all over the palace. And so the king is intrigued by this and sends everyone else from the room. Why is it that he does not fear Ehud? First, the Jew would have been searched in at least a casual way for weapons. Obviously, the Lord caused this dagger to be overlooked. It might also be that Ehud was not searched on his right side, because that would be an awkward place from which to take a weapon for a left-hander. Okay? If you've ever tried to like take something from the pocket of your opposite thing, and it can feel kind of awkward doing that. They probably figured, well, that's not going to be an issue here. Another possibility is that Ehud was unable to use his right hand. That phrase for left-handed could also mean a crippling of the right hand. Or maybe Eglon was simply the arrogant kind of person who could not imagine that one lowly Jew, who he had just, this guy had just bowed down to him, and had brought him tribute and so forth. couldn't imagine this guy coming into the palace again to kill him. Anyway, as the Lord would have it, this king was definitely not on guard. Ehud approaches even closer to the king, saying that he has a message that's actually from God. He uses the generic name for God here, Elohim, rather than Yahweh. The word is plural in the Hebrew, and we see in that the indication of the triunity of the true God. But Eglon would have understood that, you know, maybe the gods had a message for him. Kings of the day were usually superstitious in one way or another, and so anything that was sort of a supernatural communication, they were usually interested in hearing. So the king struggles to his feet, I guess as a sign of respect for the fact that he was about to receive this divine revelation. So we come to verses 21 through 25. Ehud stretched out his left hand, took the sword from his right thigh, again, you know, kind of a difficult maneuver, and thrust it into his belly. The handle also went in after the blade. And the fat closed over the blade. One of the great lines from my childhood. For he did not draw the sword out of his belly, and the refuse came out. All his insides. Then Ehud went out into the vestibule and shut the doors of the roof chamber behind him and locked them. When he had gone out, his servants came and looked, and behold, the doors of the roof chamber were locked. And they said, he's only relieving himself in the cool room. They waited until they became anxious, but behold, he did not open the doors of the roof roof chamber. Therefore they took the key and opened them, and behold, their master had fallen to the floor dead. Ehud certainly did have a message from God for Eglon. And that message was, you're dead meat. You're done. Some think that this was perhaps unspiritual of Ehud to seem to deceive Eglon in this way. I don't see that. First of all, the Jews are declaring war here, and in war, you don't observe all the normal niceties. Secondly, Ehud was raised up by God to do this deed. He was God's instrument of vengeance. He was indeed delivering a message from God, which was that if you come against God's people, you do that at your own risk. Ehud leaves the sword inside the king. He certainly didn't want to walk out through the palace, I don't think, with it. So it was just as good a place as any to leave it. Then he calmly locks the doors and makes his way out of the residence. I mean, you've got to believe his heart was pounding. But he keeps himself under control. The servants of the king would not have been around the doors because they were not to be within earshot. They were not supposed to be hearing this message. They were far enough away that they did not hear any cries that might have come from the king. These kind of doors could be locked from the outside without a key, but not opened without one. The servants saw Ehud come out, eventually, of course, and assumed he'd been dismissed, that he'd delivered whatever message there was. And when they found the doors locked, they naturally thought that the king had done that so that he might relieve himself in privacy. But as time passes, the situation becomes kind of embarrassing. What's going on in there? They don't want to barge in on the king, but surely it's getting to be a long time for using the restroom. There were likely a few tentative calls from the hall. You know, "O king, you know, your immensity, are you, you know, finished in there? You know, what's going on?" No answer. And finally, they unlock the door to find that the king is, in fact, dead. Well, let's finish the passage with verses 26 through 30. "Now Ehud escaped while they were delaying, and he passed by the idols and escaped to Sarah. It came about when he had arrived that he blew the trumpet in the hill country of Ephraim. And the sons of Israel went down with him from the hill country, and he was in front of them. He said to them, 'Pursue them, for the Lord has given your enemies, the Moabites, into your hands.' So they went down after him and seized the fords of the Jordan opposite Moab and did not allow anyone to cross. They struck down at that time about 10,000 Moabites, all robust and valiant men, and no one escaped. So Moab was subdued that day under the hand of Israel, and the land was undisturbed for 80 years. By the time the servants raised the alarm, you know, Ehud is well out and gone and headed into the hills. I would guess that he probably thumbed his nose at the idols, you know, as he went by. You're not going to be there for very long. The Lord is bringing some change to this situation. He goes to the territory of Ephraim, which was just to the north. And this was a large tribe, often used as the name of the northern kingdom of Jews. It was close to Jericho. And these people had probably suffered as much as anyone under the hand of Eglon being right there. In a short time, Ehud gathers a goodly band of warriors and leads them down into the Jordan Valley. He tells them of his success and encourages them with the message that God has given them the victory if they will only fight. You know, and this is hearkening back to the initial days of coming into this area. Yes, you have to be prepared to fight, but the Lord has given us the victory. Ehud leads the troops down to the fords of the Jordan River. Well, why do they go down there and set up and prepare to take their stand? Well, this is because Ehud's going for the total annihilation. He's going for the complete kill here. We're going to deal with this situation completely. If he goes to the palace and comes from, you know, west to east, what can happen? Well, they can drive the people before them, but they cross the Jordan and go back to their home territory of Moab, and not all that much is not as much at least is accomplished. But he doesn't want to merely chase the Moabites back east to where they came from. He wants to annihilate them. With their escape routes cut off, because they'd have to cross the Jordan River, all of the enemy inside Canaan is forced to fight to the last man. And that's what they do. 10,000 of the cream of Moabite manhood is cut down. Well, that's a lot of bodies along the Jordan. Israel was back on top in their land. And what a time of peace we see that God gives them. 80 years, that's twice as long as the one before. This is by far the longest period of rest from oppression in this book. God had used Ehud in an amazing way. Now let's turn to the harmonization section of our outline. We can note several connections with the rest of the book in this passage. We see again that things begin to get better when Israel as a whole cries out to the Lord. Verse 15 of our passage is almost word for word the same as verse 9, you know, which we had last time, except for the name of the deliverer. Othniel is replaced by Ehud, but it's the same process. Next week, we will see Israel cry out to the Lord in chapter 4, verse 3. Again, a reminder to us that humble supplication is the only remedy for the miseries of sinful behavior. Another theme that comes to the fore here is that God uses unexpected people in unexpected ways to accomplish great spiritual good. Ehud was a member of the smallest tribe of Israel. He was left-handed, which is a difficult role in a right-handed world. He may even have been crippled. Can't be sure about that. He was one person facing the might of a powerful king and a large and valiant army. One person. How many times have we probably thought, what can one person do? Or who am I, you know, to attempt something like this? Well, he certainly had that opportunity. The vast majority of us, I would think, in his position would say, there's just no way that I am going to turn this whole situation around with anything that I would do. Who would have thought that Israel's deliverance would unfold as it did? And we're going to see this theme continue with people such as Deborah and Gideon in this book. This is God's way, right? This is consistent in Scripture, because it makes clear that God is the one who delivers, not man. That this was God's design, that this was of God's doing, that you cannot explain this in human terms. And as we will see in our application in a moment, this unlikely method of deliverance did lead to a boasting in the Lord, not in man. Another tie-in here is the fact that the Jews were ready to go to war quickly. This happened pretty fast after what Ehud did. Gathers this group of warriors. Even though it had been at least 18 years since they had fought a formal battle, and maybe it had been as long as 58 years since they'd had to use their weapons, fight. Do you remember what chapter 3, verses 1 and 2 said? Now these are the nations which the Lord left to test Israel by them, that is, all who had not experienced any of the wars of Canaan, only in order that the generations of the sons of Israel might be taught war, those who had not experienced it formerly. The idea there was that God was going to keep them in fighting trim, so to speak. And so because of that, they are ready here to respond when Joshua makes the call. They were ready because of the constant presence of these nations that wanted to dominate them all around. And again, nothing much has changed, has it, for Israel? They have to be ready to fight because every man's hand is against them. I should also mention a couple of matters that are different here than in the accounts of many of the other judges. The most obvious is that it is never specifically stated that Ehud judged Israel. I mean, he's not called a judge. The same will be true with the brief description of Shamgar that we're going to look at next week. But the four commentators that I read accept these men as judges because they are presented as taking the same role as the others that are called judges. They are spiritual people who delivered Israel from her enemies. It's a little hard to imagine that after this incredible way of being used by God, that Ehud just kind of, disappeared from the national scene. Also, we don't read that the Spirit of the Lord comes upon Ehud as we did with Othniel and as we will do with other judges. Some see this as evidence of lack of spirituality on his part. But as we will see, verse 28 indicates that Ehud was a spiritual man. He was a spiritual man. The Spirit is not said to come upon Deborah or Barak either in chapter 4. But the Lord was clearly with them, and I believe he was clearly with Ehud. So I wouldn't make too much of these omissions. I think we can assume that the Spirit empowered Ehud for his deeds of deliverance. All right, a couple of applications before we close. If this passage tells us anything, it is that those who would accomplish something substantial for the Lord must have courage. If you're going to accomplish something significant for the Lord, whether it looks that way at the time or not, whether other people see it for what it is or not, it is still going to take an amount of courage. We must have some pluck if we're going to count for something in the spiritual realm. We're going to have some grit. A lot of people talk about what should be done. Many Jews were undoubtedly talking about how someone should strike a blow. Someone should rally the people. So someone should, get us unified in following the true God again. Someone ought to do something about this terrible situation. Ehud was the only guy who actually did anything about it. Most everybody in the church has ideas about what it would be really neat to do. But usually it's someone else that they have in mind to do it. It's amazing how many visions for ministry others have had over the years and have approached Allison or myself to enact them. I've just got this really great idea, a real burden from the Lord. And here, would you make it happen? Most who talk about what ought to be done don't really have much intention of actually meeting the need themselves. And you know, why is that? And I'm sure that there are many reasons, but I think a very important one is that there's not the spiritual courage, the trust in the Lord to step out in kind of a seemingly risky way. They want to leave that to other people. They don't seem to have the trust in the Lord to stand up and do what they see needs to be done. I mean, there's a reason why that's on your heart. There's a reason why the Lord has made that something that really grabs you or you know, strikes you, that's clear to you that needs to be done. But we have fears. We might sense the Lord calling us to strike a blow for him in one way or another. But we have fears about that. What if other people don't support my idea? What if I'm criticized for my actions? See, a lot of this when you're trying to get another person to do it is you're saying, I want you to be the target. I want you to have to struggle with the logistics of this thing. Now, what if I look foolish? Well, that will happen at times. All of these things will happen. If you're going to step up and actually try to accomplish something from the Lord, yes, you will be criticized. You will look foolish sometimes. You will say the wrong thing sometimes. You will have a nightmare trying to organize something. Yeah. And sometimes we find that, you know, there are good reasons for not pursuing something. Not everything, you know, should be beat to death when the Lord's not seeming to prosper it. But Ehud could have focused on how he would look if the sword he had made was discovered. Oh, what do we have here? Okay, take him away. Execute him. Boy, that would be kind of a sad and, you know, kind of silly way for this whole thing to end. Everybody in Israel would be talking about, you know, what a foolhardy attempt that was. What an idiot. Thought he would just go waltz in there with a sword and kill the king. What if it had turned out that way? He didn't let those kind of fears sideline him from what God was calling him to do. So the question that comes out to me from this text, questions are, who among us will show courage in fighting the enemy and aiding God's people? Who will be creative like Ehud, even if you have to make yourself a sword? Who will develop plans for serving the Lord and then improvise as necessary? I mean, there's no way that he could control this. A lot of us, you know, well, if I can really know exactly what's going to happen and how it's going to go down, and I've got every eventuality figured out, and I feel like I'm totally prepared and ready for anything that could happen, well, then, you know, maybe I'll think about doing it. Well, it's usually not going to be anywhere near like that. You're just going to have to, yes, have some thoughts, but wade in and let the Lord guide and show you how it's going to need to be done. Ehud didn't give up when the situation didn't just fall into his lap. There's no way that he could have predicted how this would all proceed. He persevered. And he came up with, you know, another way to fulfill his mission. Spiritual courage can be shown in many ways. Now, this is a very graphic, you know, sticking the sword right in there. And sometimes that has been God's call to obedience. I mean, if you think that something like that could never be a spiritual act, you're very far wrong. Sometimes what God wants a person to do is to stick a sword in somebody's belly. But there are many ways to show spiritual courage. It could be refusing to bow down to one of the idols of the world. I'm not going to do that. I don't care how you threaten me. I don't care how you try and get me to compromise. I'm not bowing down to that. It could be taking on a responsibility in the church. Sometimes that takes courage. It could be sharing the gospel with someone. We all know that calls for some gumption, even in our relatively free society. We sense that there could be some repercussions for doing so. Take some courage to share the gospel. This could be encouraging others with your faithfulness in a trial. You know, takes courage to trust in the Lord that He is working for good, and that there is a way that you can have a great spiritual impact on others' lives even though you are hurting to such a degree. It could be rebuking a fellow believer in love. We dealt a lot with that in the Corinthian letters. That can take a lot of courage. Let's be men and women of courage this week as we go out into whatever circumstances come our way. Lastly, let's also remember to give the credit where credit is due. We've been talking about that this morning. Ehud does a lot in this account, doesn't he? It's just remarkable. He made the sword. Apparently made a pretty good one. He took the risks, right? I mean, he was the guy standing there. Is it going to work? Am I going to die at any moment here? He devised his plans. He improvised as needed. He stuck that sword in Eglon's belly, and that's not an easy thing to do, I'll tell you. I'm going to end the life of this guy right now. He blew the trumpet. He rallied the troops. From the human standpoint, man, this is all him. He's the man. But what was his testimony after all of that effort and energy and planning and just, I can't imagine all of the emotions of all of that. The Lord has given your enemies into your hands. The Lord has done this. That is just so beautiful to see. And for somebody to say, well, he's really probably not that spiritual a guy, I just don't really see that. Because look at where his thoughts were directed after all that he had done. Look what the Lord has done, everybody. Let him who boasts, boast in the Lord. Wherever there is deliverance, the Lord is the one who brought it about. Men are usually involved, yes. Often significantly involved, but only as instruments. After we have given all that we have, when we have displayed that wonderful courage by God's grace, our conclusion in regard to any spiritual fruit that comes out of that, any good result that comes out of that must be, hey, you know what? It was really all of the Lord. Let's pray. Lord, give us that right combination of